So this morning we begin to reflect on contemplation. Everything we've done up to this point is all possible for us. We can all have the practice of spiritual reading, and we can all meditate. We can all follow the call of the Spirit of God within us into deeper meditation and prayer and even simplicity too. But now we're coming to something we can't do. I think that might be one of the most important things to say. Contemplation is not anything I or you can actually do, achieve. Everything so far we can do. And it's here that John of the Cross and Teresa are of particular help to us, because it needn't be, but it can be a bit baffling. Prayer for Teresa is essentially something very simple. She speaks of it as, and I've done this with you on the first night, but recall it again now, she speaks of it as an exercise of love, an intimate sharing between friends, taking time frequently to be alone with God, who we know loves us. She speaks of the heart as a paradise where the Lord finds delight. In its centre, says Teresa, takes place very secret exchanges between God and the soul. She comments, since we do not prize ourselves and one another as creatures deserve, being made in the image of God, we do not understand the deep secrets that lie within. The value and quality of our prayer is measured by the fruit which it produces in our lives. Our obedience, our detachment, our humility, and especially our love. And Teresa writes, it's in the effects and deeds following afterwards that one discerns the true value of prayer. Whatever happens, we must not abandon prayer. That's one thing Teresa didn't do. She didn't abandon prayer. And she writes, whatever wrong you who practice prayer might do, whatever wrong you do in your life, you must not abandon prayer. Excuse me. And if in fact you do abandon prayer, if I abandon prayer, then we must start again. Don't spend all our time regretting that we abandoned prayer or stopped praying or got busy or whatever. She writes, there's no other remedy for the evil of giving up prayer than to begin again. And I hope in the last 4 days together we've been looking at beginning again. We shouldn't expect the journey to be one of simple progression. She writes, there's no stage of prayer so sublime, and we'll be exploring how sublime her prayer was, there's no stage of prayer so sublime that it's not necessary often to go back to the beginning. So we never grow beyond all the things we've reflected on up to this point. again, some basic thoughts to prepare us for the presentation. While there's some value in studying prayer from the outside, you can read those two volumes of Marie Eugène if you wish, and I advise you to. You can read Teresa Rizzieux, you can read Elizabeth of the Trinity. I'm staying with the Carmelites, but I didn't. You can read Ignatius Loyola. We can do all these things from the outside. We will only truly be helped to the extent that we are praying. If we're not praying, we can learn what God is doing in people's lives, and that's a good thing to do. And we can get some idea of the intimate communion to which God is inviting me, each of us. However, we can't really understand Teresa or any other teacher of prayer, except to the extent that she helps shed light on our own personal experience of prayer. I'm sure that's obvious to us all, but needs to be said, I think. And this is from her own words, and from her life. As much as I desire to speak clearly about these matters of prayer, and no one has spoken more clearly about it, as much as I desire to speak clearly about these matters of prayer, they'll be really obscure for one who hasn't had experience. There's nothing wrong with not having had experience. If we haven't had it, well, we can learn about it. We can learn what's on offer. We can do all that. But we have to get in touch with our own experience and be honest about it and be quite happy if we're at the bottom row. Fidelity to the prayer practices we outlined earlier, spiritual reading, meditation, review of life, preparing our meditation, etc., liturgical prayer. Fidelity to these practices, which all of us can do if we choose to, and to striving to live a Christian life, as we talked about yesterday, meaning let Christ live in you and let Christ live in me and let us enjoy his prayer and his compassion, etc. All of this gradually sensitizes a person to the movements of God's Spirit, drawing us into love communion from the center of our center. From the seventh mansion place, the heart. So as we recite prayers, as we enter into the church's liturgy, as we meditate on the truths of our faith, and especially on the life and teaching of Jesus, and we never go beyond that, Teresa never went beyond it. Beyond is a wrong word, really, but that was always part of her prayer, the life of Jesus especially. We've grown from knowing about Jesus. If you're new, and you're not, but if you were new at the New Testament, there will be parables and scenes in there that you're not familiar with, perhaps. And they're new, and they're all beautiful, so that's good. And you're getting to know more and more, and I'm getting to know more and more about Jesus. We come to start deepening, we start to know Jesus. Familiar. And so, God. We've experienced moments of deep communion all along the way, in the middle of saying the Our Father, or in a meditation, or whatever. There comes a point, and here we are, a point where while praying in our accustomed way, we sense that the movement of our prayer is beginning to change direction. I think this is the key to what I'm offering you this morning. We become aware that the prayer is actually changing direction. Rather than, and this is all good, rather than our stretching out towards God earnestly and faithfully and desiringly, we're reaching out in response to grace, but we're reaching out. Rather than that, we experience ourselves yielding to God. As we experience, and this is Teresa's words, very beautiful, simple words, a gentle drawing inward. So we've been trying to be faithful in any case to the journey, but we're doing the, and then something happens, we feel drawn in. What Teresa of Jesus calls an interior recollection felt in the soul. So it's an experience that's different. Marie-Eugène, a Carmelite, writes, we find ourselves calmed, enveloped by another in a mantle of recollection. A gentle force holds us in recollection. I hope I'm expressing it as best I can. So it's not something we're aware, we're aware, and the other ones of what we're doing, and that's good. Here we're not aware, we're aware of what's happening to us. The Master, says Marie-Eugène, creates a disposition of silent attention and peaceful submission. Prayer is always a response to God, for it's God who creates us now and holds us now in existence. It's God who, in Paul's words, has poured love into our hearts through the Holy Spirit that has been given to us. So the prayer we've done up to this point, active prayer, often called by them, it's part of our life. And it's something we're doing, and we're aware of God dwelling in our heart, in the centre, and we're aware of being called to the centre. That's all what's happened. And now something seems to happen that's drawing us in rather than us responding by going in. In all prayer, there's an element of being caught up, of being drawn. At the same time, in the prayer that we have been focusing on up to this point, there's been a lot of climbing, a lot of striving. From the beginning, we've experienced the gifts of God's Spirit, the Spirit of communion that flows between the heart of Jesus and the heart of God dwelling within us. Through this gift, we're drawn to share Jesus' own prayer communion. Up to this point, we've been focusing our attention on the kind of prayer that we experience when we welcome the gift of the Spirit, but we are still controlling the response. All of that's good. We're still controlling the response. There comes a point where we experience what feels like a shift in the direction of our prayer. Yielding to this change of direction, this drawing, needn't be, it's a wonder that it is, but it can be problematic if we're not helped. If we're helped, it can be quite a simple thing. We can be familiar with the theory. God cannot be comprehended in our concepts. We all agree with that. God is beyond any image we have of God. We might be aware of the theory, but when we yield to the drawing of grace, we find ourselves in a strange place, an unfamiliar place. And we're tempted to ignore the yielding and revert to what we know. Kind of prayer we know, get back to the meditation, because we're familiar with it and we know what we're doing, we know what we're doing, whereas this other thing is taking us somewhere beyond concepts and images and all of that. Reverting to our accustomed ways of praying is not a bad thing, and when the experience of being drawn, it might last for a minute, time's got nothing to do with it. It might last for 5 minutes, it might last for an hour, but whatever it is, when the experience of being drawn goes, because we're not doing it, God is doing it in us. It's a good thing to go back to our meditation. That's what we're supposed to do, the one we prepared last night and are doing now. We go back to it simply and unashamedly and joyfully, please God. Because it's a good thing to do. It's just that somehow we know that this strange drawing that we've experienced is right, and that it's the path to take into more intimate communion with God. We've let the reins go, really, and we're going in whatever direction. And we sense it's right. So when it comes to us, the advice of all these beautiful people is follow it, even though it's taking you beyond where you know where you are. Go with it. Don't invent it. You can't do it. Don't organise for it to happen. Want it, but go with it. Don't go back to the familiar stuff you knew. But when the drawing is not felt, I think that's a good word, then go back to your meditation, of course. We must be courageous and let go any attachment we have to getting to know more about Jesus, more about God, read another 5 books. We somehow know that when we're aware of being drawn, and if this is an experience you've had, you'll know exactly what they're saying. Teresa and John and the others are saying. And if you aren't aware that you've had this experience, you could well have, but you may not be aware of it, that's fine. What they're doing is showing us what to expect and what to be ready for when it happens. Because God is actually drawing all of us into the seventh mansion. So there's no doubt about that. We're all being drawn into complete communion with God beyond everything. So if we can relate to this from our own experience, that's good. They're putting words on our experience. If we can't relate to it yet, don't worry, but be prepared, because it will be offered you. We somehow know that when we're aware of being drawn beyond our concepts and images and feeling, to revert to them in those moments or time of being drawn, we sense is being unfaithful to something. It's not the same. And when we do so, what once was experienced as pleasurable, meditation, it no longer is. It's somehow not right. And we must trust our experience. It's not as though something new is beginning. God isn't waiting to offer this to you. God's always been drawing us into love communion. God doesn't change. Rather, if I'm right, I hope I am, it's that we have not been sensitive enough to pick up this drawing. We've stayed with what we were familiar with, fair enough. We're growing in sensitivity, so we're noticing something that's been there for a while, but we haven't noticed it. What's new is our awareness. Teresa advises us to keep up our practices. Keep preparing your prayer and your meditation and your spiritual reading and your prayer of the church, if that's part of your practice. Teresa says, keep it up. But don't cling to these practices when we experience this unfamiliar drawing. Yield to it, she says. Teresa calls the prayer we experience at this stage of our journey, it's in the fourth mansion, if you want to be technical about it, she calls it the prayer of recollection. And the prayer of recollection deepens into what she calls the prayer of quiet. a stillness and silence unlike the kind of stillness and silence that we can bring about, which we looked at earlier. We can have techniques for silence, body silence, breathing silence, mantras. We can do all of that. And we can, not always, but we've usually, we can create, with right techniques and spirit, we can create a certain quiet and a certain silence. It'll come clear in a minute, but Teresa and John of the Cross are absolutely clear. Don't confuse that with contemplation. It's beautiful, and do it, but it's not contemplation. Contemplation is something we can't do. We can only welcome. We can long for this prayer, this yielding, drawn, consciously being drawn into the centre. We can long for this prayer and we can prepare for it by practicing silence, of course, but there's nothing we can do to bring about this prayer. So don't try to do it. It's for this reason that Teresa calls this prayer, I don't find it the happiest of expressions, but she does. She calls it supernatural. Her intention is to say, our own nature can't achieve it. She uses a rather helpful image, see if it helps you. In our prayer, we've been drawing water from the well. So the garden is here in your soul. It's a paradise, a garden. And we've been going over there to read Blessed Elizabeth of the Trinity or someone. And we've been drawing water out of that well. And we've been bringing that water to the garden, and watering the garden. And with God's help, that's what we've been doing. Now, we experience an unexpected welling up from a spring deep within the garden itself. I hope that helps. It helps me anyhow to understand. So the other is very beautiful, the water provided there that we bring in and water the garden with God's grace and in response to God's call. But this is something different. The water is not coming from out there, and you must be thinking of Jesus and the woman at the well. I will give you a spring of water within you that will well up to eternal life. So this is the experience of something coming from the centre, welling up in us. And this is what Teresa calls contemplation. These are her own words in what she calls the fourth dwelling place, where all this is beginning to be aware of this. She says, we receive contemplation from the spring which is God himself, who produces delight in the very interior part of ourselves. Prayer is always a delight. Some of the language is going to come in later in the and we've got to be aware of it, but it's all about joy and communion and love, so it's about delight. From the spring which is God himself, who produces delight in the very interior part of ourselves, this delight fills everything. Overflowing, she writes from her own experience, overflowing through all the dwelling places and faculties and reaching the body. It begins in God and ends in ourselves, and our whole exterior enjoys this spiritual delight and sweetness. This is not something we can imagine for ourselves, she says. And no matter how hard we strive, we cannot acquire it. I hope that's clear. It's vital. If it's something you can acquire by joining a meditation group, how beautiful is that? by going to a charismatic meeting, by doing some centering prayer with Thomas Keating, by whatever. If you can, if it's something you can acquire, beautiful, enjoy it. But it's not contemplation. Contemplation is something far more profound and God-centered than anything else. And that's not to knock any of the other. It's all beautiful. Teresa's mystical experience began, she says, with a feeling of the presence of God, and I'm quoting from her life, it would come upon me unexpectedly, so that I could in no way doubt that God was with me and I was totally immersed in God. Again, Teresa, do not think that this recollection is acquired by the intellect striving to think about God within itself. And that's a beautiful thing to do, but it doesn't lead to this. Such efforts are good, she writes, and they're excellent. It's an excellent kind of meditation because they're founded on a truth, which is that God is within us. But this is not the prayer of recollection, because it's something which each of us can do, with the help of God, of course, as should be understood of everything. What I'm speaking of here comes in a different way. Sometimes, before even beginning to think of God, one noticeably senses a gentle drawing inward. This doesn't come when we want it. And Maria Jean writes, out of the darkness of the mystery, which is God who's beyond everything, out of the darkness of the mystery there arises through the gifts of the Holy Spirit a confused light. Confused is a difficult word because it has a bit of negativity in it. We don't need that. It means it's not something you can see clearly. And I know not what, he says, that makes one find peace and sweetness in the mystery, that holds faith there or brings it back, freeing it from the discursive operations of the intellect and causing it to find rest and support in this light beyond all distinct lights. And John of the Cross, which I kind of fiddle with Spanish, but I don't know it, and not certainly don't know it enough to do it here, but they tell me John of the Cross is the best Spanish lyric poet. It's wonderful. Well, poetry, of course, and prayer are probably the same. But so he's got that gift as well to be able to express in poetry, and I'll just read you this and a little bit of his commentary. Oh, spring, he says, like crystal. There's your crystal. Teresa's image of the castle, crystal. Oh, spring, like crystal, if only on your silvered over face you would suddenly form the eyes I have desired, which I bared sketched deep within my heart. The gospel has eyes. These are the eyes of Jesus, the eyes that are looking, and he's longing for that. In his commentary on this stanza, John writes, faith gives us God, but covered over with the silver of faith. It doesn't for that reason fail to give God to us. Were someone to give us a gold vase plated with silver, he wouldn't fail to give a gold vase merely because it's silver plated. So with the dogmas of our faith, which we learn and which we teach to our children, please God, and our grandchildren, then these truths They're the silvered over, but in them is a mystery which the child, the young person, anyone, the adult, will, it'll feed the soul. The truths of faith, writes John, they're called eyes because of the remarkable presence of the beloved which we experience. It seems that he's now always looking at us. He's describing contemplation with different, from a different angle. Over the sketch of faith is drawn in the will of the lover the sketch of love. When there's union of love, the image of the beloved is so sketched in the will and drawn so intimately and vividly that it's true to say that the beloved lives in the lover, this is still John, and the lover lives in the beloved. Love produces such likeness in this transformation of lovers that one can say each is the other and both are one. This is because in the union and transformation of love, each gives possession of self to the other, and each leaves and exchanges self for the other. Thus each one lives in the other and is the other, and both are one in the transformation of love. He's trying to use words to cover something that can't be expressed in words. This is the meaning of Paul's affirmation, this experience that Paul had. I live, no longer I. It's Christ who is living in me. John, that's John of the Cross, is aware of the importance of theological contemplation, and so of the teachings and traditions of the church that are the silver plating. The formulas that express in words the truths revealed by God, they're not empty. They clothe the substance of divine truth itself that is revealed in them. If we submit humbly to this teaching, and may I add in brackets, so important that the teaching be clear. And some of our teaching is not clear. It's come from twisted theology that's found its way into the habits of teaching. I'll give you a quick example from the creed that we read, the Apostles' Creed. He descended into hell. Well, don't put your hands up, but it's not unlikely that people think hell, because they're taught about hell. Hell's the place where the devil is, you know, and there's fire and eternal punishment and all that. It's got nothing to do with the creed. That's not what the creed is saying. There are two words, Greek words, that are both translated by hell. Well, we've got to do something better than that. One of them is Gehenna, which is hell. Jesus doesn't descend into Gehenna. The other is Hades, the mythical Greek world, underworld, where the dead, where we go when we're buried. So Jesus is saying he is here, he loved you, he loved the people on Calvary, he loved his mother and the beloved disciple and the thief on the cross. But the meaning of his life also encompasses the whole of previous history. He goes down into the realm of the dead. Again, we're dealing with mythology. But he goes down into the realm of the dead and brings everyone into the full love of God. That's the image that we're meant to have. It's still awkward, I think, but it's got nothing to do with hell. Do you take my meaning?
Yeah.
So our theology, we need good theology all the time, because good theology faces us towards the mystery. The mystery. Bad theology faces us in a wrong direction. And there's plenty of bad theology around, sadly. The formulas that express in words the truths revealed by God, they're not empty. They clothe the substance of divine truth itself that is revealed in them. If we submit humbly to this teaching, Grace can lead us to penetrate the mystery that the formulas express. It's one thing to delight in the revealed truth. It's another to experience myself being caught up in the gaze of the one for whom my heart longs. John is praying that eyes would be revealed to him. In contemplation, our attention is not on any insights. Nothing wrong with looking at insights. It's important. But in contemplation, that's not where our attention is. It's not on any insights that we may receive, important though these can be. Beyond all insights, we experience ourselves yielding to what we might call the gravity of grace, drawing us into where the Trinity dwells. We don't want our attention to wander from the mysterious presence that is drawing us into communion, the experience, the presence we call God. In contemplation, we are being transformed into love by the all-consuming love that is God. Like a drop of water, we're being drawn into the ocean of God's love and are being absorbed into it. Teresa writes, "The important thing," and this is when she's describing precisely the topic I'm attempting to present now, she says, "The important thing is not to think much, but to love much." Accompanying this experience of love, there is joy, of course, as well as a sense of belonging, communion, and peace. We've experienced moments of this communion ever since we began to pray, but now there's a difference. The current of communion is drawing us beyond images, beyond thoughts. This is the love for which we're made and for which we long. The communion in love that we experience is experienced as gifted, not achieved. Gifted. We're quite aware of the fact that the silence, the stillness, the welling up of joy, of gratitude, or sorrow, or pleading, is not something that we're initiating. We may have prepared for it, but we haven't initiated it. It wells up unexpectedly, and our hearts know that we're responding mysteriously to God. Contemplation can come to any person at any time, for God invites everyone to the intimate communion for which we are created. Gerald May writes in quite an astonishing book, The Awakened Heart, he writes, "Contemplation happens to everyone. It happens in moments when we are open and undefended and immediately present." As we mature and as we become more committed to prayer and more earnest in avoiding sin, we need to listen to Jesus as he tells us that we will find ourselves only when we learn to lose ourselves. And that we must become like a little child if we're to enter into the dwelling place of love into which he is inviting us. I suspect, without knowing, that actually children, little children, the only prayer they know is contemplation. But of course, They have to become, I have to become me, you have to become you, we have to develop an ego, and we've got all that going, and education can be come from outside instead of drawing out from us. We get pounded by education or schooling or whatever, and don't want to knock any of that. So all that happens, and so as we grow, we can lose this simple gift, and we have to kind of re-find it. We need to be ready to let go the ego that we've developed. And along with our ego, much of what we've come to know about God and about ourselves, these are all thoughts, you see, in order to surrender in love to God, the God that's beyond everything, we experience ourselves being called into recollection by love. It's when we begin to surrender in this way, to let go control, that we begin to experience intermittent moments of contemplation. The way Teresa experienced them, intermittent. Later they become habitual. In these graced moments, everything is experienced as a sacrament of the divine. Everything, in Hopkins' words, is charged with the grandeur of God. In these graced moments, we experience a new kind of presence in which we're not alone, but are embraced by the one who gives harmony to the music of creation and in whom all things hold together. Our mind rests in the true that is given, the true that is beyond the truths that we discover through the efforts of reason and logic. Our will rests in the good that is given, the good that is beyond any efforts we're making to live a consistently moral life. In these graced moments of the beginnings of contemplation, our feelings rest in the beautiful that is given, the beautiful that is beyond anything that we might appreciate by our own efforts. We can receive these graced moments in the measure that we're willing to let go control and entrust ourselves wholly to God. Whereas before, we experienced ourselves, and this was all good, we experienced ourselves seeking and striving and wanting to be faithful and marvellous. But now, something's a bit different. Now, we experience ourselves receiving and welcoming. This communion is offered to everyone who is willing to surrender to love. Teresa of Jesus writes, "It's certain that God gives himself in this way to those who give up all for God. God shows no partiality. God loves everyone. Nobody has any excuse, no matter how miserable you may be, since God so acts with me," says Teresa, "in bringing me to this state." And she says, if God gave this to me after, she doesn't say this, but after 20 years of pretty mediocre religious life and all of that, if God gave this gift to me, he must be giving it to everybody, she says very wisely. It's important to remember that we can experience contemplation in the midst of activity as well as in the stillness of prayer. For whenever we're doing God's will, we're open to God's gift of God's self in this way. There's a lot in the Gospel of Jesus going off to the mountain to pray. There's an immense amount in the Gospel of Jesus walking through the hamlets and healing and caring and teaching and so on. So if Jesus was in contemplation, which he clearly was, everywhere at every moment, then that's important. Our focus here, however, in this retreat, is not on contemplative action, beautiful as that is. It's on contemplative prayer. Though we're mindful of the call of St. Dominic. That's not the St. Dominic here that we have in our community. He is that, but this is the other one that we know about. And they keep shifting his feast to fit. And the very humble Mary MacKillop in dear St. Dominic. It's always hard to find when we're celebrating his feast. Anyhow, I've got St. Dominic, by the way, that St. Dominic, on my desk. I've had it there for years because it's so wonderful. Anyhow, this is St. Dominic. To share with others what we've received in contemplation. This was his saying, contemplata, those things that you've contemplated, tradere, hand them on. And Ignatius of Loyola teaches us to be contemplative in all our activity. In actione, you can guess that even if you don't know Latin, in action, be contemplative. So they're both telling us the same thing. But our focus here is on contemplative prayer. If we're willing to remain open to these graced moments when God draws us beyond all our thoughts, however beautiful, and all our feelings, and if we resist the temptation to take control of them, or to possess them, or to attempt to reproduce them, that's a big temptation for some of us. You've had a moment of prayer beautifully and you want to have it again, of course. So you set about setting it up again. Well, you can't. If we resist the temptation to do this, God's longing to be in communion with us is such that transient experiences of recollection tend to deepen, so that we find ourselves wrapped in what Teresa calls the prayer of quiet, quiet prayer. Not the achieved quiet, but the given quiet. In an earlier reflection, we spoke of a simple form of prayer in which we held ourselves quietly in the presence of God, a prayer of simple regard. In some ways, the prayer we're describing here appears similar. The essential difference, and I'm sorry I've said this about four times, but the essential difference is that this experience of contemplative prayer is one that we can only receive and welcome as a gift. Thank God, or we might think we can do it and we're better than people who can't. As noted earlier, we can desire it, please. We can prepare for it, but we can't bring it about. Gerald May says, any attempt to create a contemplative attitude, I think we use the word contemplation and contemplative too loosely, and often we do. Well, any attempt to create a contemplative attitude will lead to frustration, or worse, self-delusion. When we were in control of our prayer, and at the right time that wasn't a bad thing, we worked for such quiet. Now the quiet wells up from the mysterious depths. We're drawn into an experience of prayer from within. Earlier, we found ways of quietening our imagination, memory, and mind. Now, surprised by grace, these same imagination, memory, and mind are absorbed and are looking as though in wonder at what they see. Now, the water that is refreshing our garden comes from its own source, says Teresa, which is God. Thinking of God as being in our centre, radiating God's love, Teresa states, the warmth and the fragrant perfumes spread through our entire being. Now, the touch of God leaves us dissatisfied with any other pleasure. We long for the communion experienced in the silence and the stillness. God has always been offering us, indeed offering everyone, the gift of communion. The difference is that now we're ready to allow ourselves to be drawn, to be caught up, to be surprised by grace. Now our prayer is no longer guided by our previous experience or any efforts of our mind or will. We're conscious of ourselves being moved and inspired. We're conscious of ourselves, of surrendering ourselves in love. God is leading us on the way of love. And again, Gerald May, contemplative prayer is allowing the source of love to bring us toward the place which is our home. We were assiduously and carefully and constantly, and this is beautiful, trying to journey and improve and be more faithful and etc. Well, that's what we've been doing, and they were all good things. Now we're a bit closer to the heart, and we feel the warmth and the drawing and the drawing in rather than journeying in. Teresa is not saying that now that we've begun to experience moments of contemplation or times of contemplation, she's not saying that everything's now light and love. We're the recipients of a wonderful grace of communion, but we're not yet in heaven. In contemplative prayer, we're in the presence of the sacred mystery that we call God. We are therefore in touch with the one who's at the heart of everything. But the closer we come to the heart, the more we're drawn into the mystery of God who transcends any and every creature. Being transcendent, God cannot be contained or controlled. Being immanent, God opens us up to the real world of our own real world of grace and disgrace. Contemplative prayer, therefore, opens us, in Vatican II's terms, to the joys and hopes, but also to the griefs and anxieties of the people of our time, especially those who are poor or afflicted in any way. And as we read, watch the gospel, and we watch Jesus' heart being broken and disturbed by the people who are harassed and they haven't got a shepherd, and he gives himself to teaching them all day, the heart of Jesus is broken and hurt, and of course, often, he's in contemplation. It doesn't stop all that happening. In the words of Gerald May, it opens us to the suffering and brokenness of the world as much as to its joy and beauty. We shouldn't expect it to be otherwise, for prayer engages us within with the ultimately real. I'll conclude with this and then offer you some music, and then return to the topic later in the morning. It's in contemplative prayer that God is transforming us, so that like St. Paul, we'll be able to say, I live, no longer I, it's Christ who is living in me. Our mind is being transformed into the mind of Christ. Our heart is becoming his heart. It is his communion of love that we're being invited to experience. And John of the Cross has this image, which at night you probably can see often enough. A log in a fire requires a profound purification. And you watch the log in the early stages and it's spitting and hissing because there's there's dampness in it, and it blackens, and till our whole being is transformed into fire, the coals, the glowing fire, by the all-consuming fire of God's love, letting go our ego, like the log of wood does, blackening and hissing, and well, that can be, for some not, but for many, yes. And we've got to be helped to journey so that we're taught to let go. And the quicker we let go, the better. In the following presentations, we'll look at some of the difficulties we can encounter in the early stages of contemplative prayer. And I'll play for you a piece of music I've already played, but I think it fits too well not to do it again, called By a Presence